things that 2297 would accomplish would change the person for whom counsel has been appointed to individuals who are eligible for court-appointed counsel would be able to apply for the indigent defense account to cover such expenses. This may seem like a fine distinction, but the reason it's sponsored jointly by the state bar and also by the state court administrator's office is because we have a growing number of attorneys in the state of Oregon who are participating in what's called the Modest Means Program. It's a program that is sponsored by the Oregon State Bar, encouraged by the Oregon State Bar, and provides counsel to individuals who are in the middle range of income. We have many attorneys out there who are signing up to provide representation to people charged, for example, with crime, who have modest ability to retain counsel. But we found, based on current experience, that some attorneys who would otherwise be willing to accept a retainer from an individual who is of modest means will not accept that client because they do not have the funds, in addition to the cost for retaining counsel, to provide for investigation or if an expert witness is needed. The other situation we're encountering is an adult person who is charged with a crime may find themselves in a situation where a friend or a family member will advance the funds to retain counsel to represent that individual on the criminal case. The adult defendant can qualify for indigent defense, but there's someone else out there who will assist in retaining counsel. In those circumstances, under the current law, because the individual has retained counsel, even though the person is indigent, we cannot authorize expenditures from the indigent defense account. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is a bill that we have prepared a fiscal impact statement on that does not have a negative fiscal impact, at least in the estimation of the Oregon State Bar and the State Court Administrator's Office. Excuse me, and there has been no opposition to this bill on the House side or known to me on this side. And with that, if there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Thank you very much. Where is my counsel? Can this go out? All right. Anybody? Nobody? 2297, right? No amendments?
No amendments, Mr. Chair.
All right.
I didn't accomplish amendment today.
All right, everybody, I'm going to move it. Unless somebody didn't want me to move it, say now. I move House Bill 2297. Yes, sir.
Are you public hearing or work session?
Excuse me. Close the public hearing, open the work session. Senator Tarver moves House Bill 2297 to forward due for SS's recommendation. Did you say move it or not?
Yes, sir.
Because you're going to carry it. Any objections? Senator Tarver carries the bill. All right, give me another one. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Nobody wants to do.
This one here, Security Cross. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we can't go to a work session in this bill because of a conflict amendment coming.
We can public hearing it?
Today, but we got a public hearing.
The quickies, everybody will come up here very fast.
That's true, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Okay. We'll public hearing on House Bill 3012, and I want Tim Pittsburgh. You know who you are, Tim. Oh, yeah, this is a good one. Oh, yeah. Rod Harder. I like that. I'll bring up Danny Santos, too. I bring up... Where's Danny? Let me see. I suppose... Here's the one. Here's the building. We're not talking about females in the room.
I'm telling you in that radio.
Mr. Chair, 3012.
Chairman of the committee, what I need to inform the committee to do is a very similar bill that was passed under the Senate that went to the House that came up with the issue committee. And I've been informed by members of the conference office At some point, some committee will have to make some policy decisions.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I said, wait a minute.
That's right.
Wait a minute. This is the heading evil bit.
That's right. That's not identical, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Good afternoon. Where are we, Mr. Vice Chair?
Well, we've already passed the bill out while you're outside the hall. We've called DC up to give a public hearing on this bill, so that's where we're at.
Right. Thanks. And for those that are here on 555, the amendments are now ready. Anne has just placed them on the back of the table. And we will take this bill up tomorrow. It's scheduled for tomorrow. That'll give us 24 hours to read the amendments. And the good news is I think we have an agreement, so at least that's my perception, and so we'll pass the bill out tomorrow.
This is the proverbial we.
Who's we? Yeah, I don't know who's
this.
This is the royal we.
F-L-U, who the we is?
Well, when I use that word in the family setting, and I'm speaking with my wife, that's usually...
He was involved in negotiations.
No, this, but I said, we should do this. And she refers to it as the royal we.
Mm-hmm.
And so, using that analogy as it relates to the committee, probably when I say we, I'm talking about the royal we here, too.
This is the royal we.
It depends on the subject. Good afternoon. Welcome. Rod, you want to start?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, representative from the National Rifle Association for Oregon. House Bill 3012 is, in fact, a portion of it is the Eddie Eagle program, as we did pass in Senate Bill 887. However, this bill takes it one step further, and I think I have discussed it with some members of the committee. The original portion of the bill in Section 1 does talk about firearm safety training, just like the Senate Bill 887 did. In Section 3, we establish a joint task force that will look into firearms training firearm safety training for the next step, which would be grade 7 through 12. It sets up a task force. It has members from appointed by the Superintendent of Public Instruction, one member jointly by the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, representing the School Boards Association, three members appointed by the President of the Senate. They shall be one member from law enforcement, one person from a state or national organization to promote safe use of firearms, and a member from the Senate and a member from the House. And that task force is charged with developing a program for safety of firearms in schools. Now, I will stop there and turn it over to Mr. Pitzer, who has been involved in a program of this type already. And we have been developing it with private funds, and they have, I think, laid a fairly good background or a fairly good foundation for this. And with that, Mr. Pitzer can tell you about the program he is currently involved with. He is the state coordinator for Eddie Eagle, and he has taken on this other duty on his own hook, and I commend him for that.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. My name is Tim Pitzer. I'm Vice President of the Oregon State Shooting Association and the Eddie Eagle Coordinator for Oregon. Over the course of the last few years in doing the Eddie Eagle program throughout the state, and we're in over 100 cities now in Oregon with Eddie Eagle, I'm always getting asked about a firearms program for the middle and high school level. To say that they've been requesting it would be an understatement, and more accurate would be that they're demanding it. So in Albany, we put together a team to do that, and our team consists of school administrators, teachers, curriculum managers, the city police departments, emergency room managers, and citizens. Whereas with Eddie Eagle, the basic message is stop, don't touch, leave the area, and tell an adult. The message for the older kids is your choice, because it is their choice what they do when they're in a situation. They have to make the right choices, and it's their responsibility to do so. This may sound kind of simplistic, but we have to give the kids the right tools to make the right choices. Let's see. And so it was our intention to make of the presentation simple but effective, not gory or scary, using a few carefully selected slides and MRI images, true stories of people who have made the wrong choices and the consequences they suffered. We'll begin presenting the program this summer, and we'll solicit information or input from the PTA, citizens groups, community organizations, and school and medical personnel. We'll evaluate, make adjustments, and have the program in place by September. And as I said before, the main premise of it is to give the kids the knowledge and the discipline and the ways to get out of a situation. If they're in a car and a friend pulls out a firearm in the car, they're to make some kind of excuse to get out of that car. If they're in at a party, someone pulls out a firearm and starts showing it around, somebody's already made a bad choice. That's the one to pull it out. They need to leave the area, get out of there, go up to a friend, say, hey, we're leaving. And it's awareness. And that's the whole key to it. They have to be aware of what can happen, the consequences of what can happen, and be aware so they can make the right choice to leave. We also have events lined up for during the summer months when the kids are out a lot to keep this as a positive reinforcement, a reminder for them to make the right choice.
Did you both testify in favor of Senate Bill 887?
Yes, sir.
And I understand that's on the House, coming up on the House floor?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And I understand some of the significances, differences of the two bills.
Mr. Chair, I think to clarify that, Section 1 is substantially, Section 1 and 2 are substantially the same. Section 3 is the big change. There is no mention of a task force. The other bill is very quick and clean, and it only applies to grades 1 through 6. It has no fiscal. This has a considerable fiscal attached to it. It has a referral for Ways and Means should it come out of this committee. If there is a conflict, as a suggestion, it could be appropriate to remove Section 1 from this bill and just pass the task force portion, as the other, the Eddie Eagle bill, has cleared committee and will be voted on the House floor, and hopefully we'll have positive results with that bill.
So is your strategy here to have two bills in the event this one dies in Ways and Means because of the cost?
Mr. Chair, that's the strategy.
All right. Thank you. All right.
You talked about your curriculum for older children, and I assume you're talking about high school kids, is to provide them with a choice and to give them the tools to make the right decision. And my concern is, given that we have a very high teen suicide rate here in Oregon, it's the second leading cause of death of young people in this state, and a huge portion of the suicide deaths are, I believe over 60%, are related to guns. My concern is, why not be keeping them to just say no? And one of the analogies I can come up with is teen pregnancy prevention, that we're focusing on abstinence-based, and obviously young people have choices, and it's better to give them the tools, but why not encourage them to just say no in the teenage years with guns, particularly with the high teen suicide rate?
Well, then, with the high suicide rate, that's also a problem with access. And part of our program is, in fact, we have, like you notice in your brochure there, you got the Parents Guide for Gun Owners, and that's in an awareness program for the parents. The firearm safety has to do with the parents just as much as the children, for them to be aware of where their firearms are, as far as the kids getting access to them. The suicide is a very complicated issue, of course, and I think by being aware of, for one thing, the program, what can happen with a firearm, some of these slides are like I say, we don't try to scare the kids or anything, but we do show them what happens when a bullet enters the body, as far as and it just makes an awareness of what's going to happen to them. And there's also the consequences of some people who survive and the way that they have to live.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you. On page 2, line 22 of the A and Gross bill, it says that the program that the task force will develop may include a course of the type of card to demonstrate the competency with a handgun necessary to obtain a concealed handgun license in Oregon. Do you really think it's appropriate to be training older children in school time how to use a handgun?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, we discussed that the sponsor of this bill felt it was appropriate to include it. I felt it was appropriate to include it as a may rather than a shall if the task force determines that that should not be a part of their recommendation, then so be that. But the option for the task force to decide, we felt, should be included in there. There is a wide variety, there are a wide variety of groups represented, and they could well determine they do not want to include that.
Chairman, follow up. I see no reference in here as to any consideration about mental health issues or stability issues with children. I just see this permission to teach children how to use handguns in school, and I'm troubled by that, since there seems to be no guidelines as to what kind of children could attend this, and the fact that it's in school hours.
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, that will be a, well, it's surprising to me that you would feel that way. I think that anyone who understands anything, driving a car, how to use a tractor, using a firearm, anyone that understands how they function and work is in a far better position to make some choices and just treat this thing, whatever it may be, with more respect. That's my opinion on that subject. But again, I would go back to, this is a task force that is going to develop a recommendation for the next session of the legislature. We have included people from the medical community as members of that task force, and it would seem to me that it is their job to make those determinations, and they may well decide that that should not be a component of this course.
Thank you.
Thank you. Danny.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, Danny Santos, Governor's Office. I just brought forth in the letter I have for you, I'll just touch on the high points here, the bill is being considered. There's really three concerns we would like to raise. One is the mandated provision of this during regular school hours, while in fact schools are struggling with the other academic programs that they have. The second point basically is that in the House, there was testimony that there were resources available that could provide these services to schools at this time, basically on a free basis. This bill, nor does Senate Bill 887, address what happens if those resources are no longer made available to school districts. And lastly, I think it's been referenced here today through the efforts last session to provide this type of gun safety training. These are available currently to school districts, and as you can see, the demand and the use of these programs is taking place, and already districts can, in fact, utilize these programs. In testifying before the House, I did indicate that both Senate Bill 887 and this bill, House Bill 3012, the mandated provisions are something that we could not support. I will also clarify one other difference, I believe, that exists between the two bills. I believe this bill, House Bill 3012, does have a provision for a parent opt-out in the bill. I don't believe Senate Bill 887 has an opt-out provision, so I'll check on that, but I believe there is a difference there.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Santos? Thank you for your testimony. Wilma Wells and Jim Green.
Mm-hmm. The chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Our main concern with this bill is on the first page, in which it mandates that we acquire a firearm safety program and provide that in K through sixth grade. We believe that we're having a hard enough time right now meeting the academic standards in those grades for our students, and adding one more class, one more requirement, takes time away from the academics. This bill has been touted as a safety bill. I believe you're missing a significant population of children then, because I find it a bit ironic that we talk about how mandates are bogging down schools, and we want to create charter schools that don't have curriculum mandates and don't have mandates in them, but this bill leaves out that population of students now that Senate Bill 100 appears to be going to be signed by the governor, and we will have charter schools. In addition, you leave private schools out and homeschooled students out. So I believe the advocates that are saying this is a safety issue don't get at the population of students that are in Oregon. We believe this is a mandate on public schools. It requires us to acquire that fire safety program, and it would be costly, not only in resources for dollars, but resources for our staff and time as well in our elementary schools. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Did you also oppose Senate Bill 887?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Wilma Welsh. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I see some other difficulties with this particular bill. We did not testify in relation to 887, Senator Bryant, because our feeling was that was 1 hour a day and sort of looked 1 hour a year, sort of looked like somebody else would do the teaching and we would have financial support for it. This bill seems to me like a very strange bill indeed, and I cannot believe that the legislature would consider passing it, because in the first place, as I read it, if you look at line 20, the state sets up a committee to write curriculum for gun safety for students from 7 through 12. And then the state says that if you're going, our committee writes this curriculum, it has to have the approval of a national or a state organization with technical expertise in firearms and an extensive history of teaching firearm safety. Well, when you teach health, and I have in schools, you don't have to have the medical profession approve what you're going to teach for health. And it seems to me that that's one mistake that if the legislature approves that bill, that would be one mistake to turn it over to an outside agency that is not governmental. Another one that I find very objectionable is the inclusion of even may, and I'm not against guns, that it may require adopt a program that would teach children how the kind of information that they need so that they can get a concealed handgun license. Somehow or other, I don't think that we need any children in our schools these days who carry a concealed handgun. I'm sorry to get emotional about this bill, but it seems to me to be a real crinker.
Jim, do you know if school districts are required to teach things like driver's ed?
Mr. Chairman, no, they're not required to teach driver's ed. Most school districts have it as the optional for students to take.
Senate Bill 887 only requires the adoption of the Eddie Eagle program if it was existing on the effective date of the Act, and then the rest is a may, so it's an optional program. Probably, and it works. Let me we'll do this in a moment. Are there any questions for these witnesses?
Yes, sir. Follow up on the CARB issue. So schools are not required to teach driver education, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, that's correct.
And so there's no adaptive curriculum for that issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I believe that's correct as well.
Okay. Each district has its own curriculum, though, if they have a driver safety program.
Senator Bryan, Senator Brown might respond to that also. There are contractors who also teach that course for school districts. They don't have to. If they don't contract with the school district, they don't get the reimbursement that's available for the students' training.
Okay. And the reason I bring that up is not just out of the air, but it seems to me in terms of relative safety issues, my guess is that more teenagers have access to cars than they do to guns, and that on levels of priorities, we're going to mandate things. I would think that we'd want to be mandating driver education. So, just a comment.
Mr. Chairman, also on Senate Bill 887, I believe that even if the Eddie the Eagle program is not available, we are still required in 887 to acquire a program from either a national or state organization that has firearm safety districts. So there is still that requirement, even if the Eddie the Eagle program isn't available or changes, I believe the way 887 is written, if it changes its philosophy on gun ownership, whether it would encourage or discourage.
Yes,
number.
It was probably very clear in the beginning of Article 887, otherwise everyone hasn't voted for it, that it does not limit the curriculum to Eddie the Eagle. There are other organizations, Oregon Public Access University, National Ceasefire, that offer educational programs about gun safety, and they would be eligible to hire them as well. There's the option of the school district.
887 doesn't require Eddie Eagle. It says you can adopt another program if you want.
That's correct.
All right. The committee, probably, Senator Courtney raises a point, too, that he believes he carried a bill out of the Education Committee.
He did.
That was different than 887. Was it 887?
No, 887. You carried 887. I just took.
Right.
Carried by Courtney passed. 27 I vote.
Well, why don't we do this? We're going to refresh our memories. I'll close the public hearing on this bill. Let's be consistent. And what I would suggest is let's take a look at 887 and make sure what we do is consistent with what we've done already in the session.
We have it right here.
And we have copies of it. The other thing that I do like in 3012 that should be considered is the parent opt-out, if they don't want them to participate. And then the portion that's new that requires us to go to Ways and Means is the task force. But my suggestion, and I appreciate someone who'd volunteer to take a look at this, would be to make sure we're consistent with what we've done in the past on the Senate floor with the new idea that's here. Sen Duncan.
Can you close it?
I just closed the public hearing.
I'm just concerned. I keep seeing all these things coming forward, and I really get upset with the mandate. And I think as he was testifying, I heard him say he's in over 100 school districts right now. And, you know, we only have 190-some of school districts right now. So the system seems to be working without a mandate for the legislative assembly. I want to caution us doing that sort of thing with a mandate.
Senator Courtney has an announcement.
You know, wait a minute. The bill that I carried in the Senate floor did not talk about Eddie Eagle. It did not talk about Eddie Eagle. I wonder what the devil's going on here. I don't know where it got B engrossed, but the A engrossed vote never mentions Eddie Eagle. It was just, we amended it twice because we said, instead of just national, we said state organization. And we added the word discourage because they had it in there. They shall not discourage gun ownership, and I added the word or encourage. It's very straight to the point, simple bill, if you know what I mean. Left it open to the school district to come up with a plan they want. That's all it was, grade K through 5. Very simple bill. So,
and let the record reflect that it was the A and growth.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on Senator Duncan's comment about mandates, if we're going to impose mandates about people doing certain school districts requiring certain types of programs, we should at least provide for enforcement and provide the Department of Education to have the resources to enforce these mandates that we're passing. Otherwise, one might argue we're wasting our time and energy.
Well, the other issue is if being gross 887 passes the House, it'll come back to the Senate for concurrence, and I suggest that Senator Duncan and Senator Courtney might have a word with Senator Hardtime about whether or not to concur.
All right. We will now go into a work session on House Bill 2226. And I would invite Jim Garrett, John Heenan, and my crew to come forward. And as they come forward, we have a whole bunch of amendments that do a wide variety of things on this issue. Mr. Taylor has had two work groups trying to talk about this and come up with a solution. Let me tell you what the chair's concerns are and why I want to do something. The bill that we have had on required mandatory reporting was never intended, I believe, to create a private cause of action. And most states who have mandatory reporting for professionals do not require or do not create a private cause of action. And we're going to, I think, hear some testimony about the consequences of when that happens. So I'm open to ideas. I'm not saying we're going to work the bill today and move something out, but I'd like to find a solution. Yes, Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, just a comment generally. Given that the amendments to the bill have become fairly controversial, I'd say that's an understatement. It seems to me that we should find another vehicle to address the liability issues and allow the SED, DOJ portion of the bill to move forward. Since we're only doing this as gracious hosts.
I understand. Well, I'll leave that option open. Let us talk about the issues today since we have the witnesses here. And first, Mr. Taylor will describe each of the dash amendments, and then we'll open it up for the invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As you mentioned, we had a work group, and we met twice. We basically had two different groups at this meeting. The first meeting was more policy people, the second meeting was more legal type. I'm not saying we came to an agreement. As a result of that meeting, in addition to the amendments that we already had, each party asked to have additional sections on the chapter. The A2 amendments come from the dental hygienist, and they include them in the bill, so the hygienist would now be a profession within the definition of private official that would have to report. The A3 include dental hygienist and remove the provisions limiting the bill to the scope of employment issues. That would be in the language on page 2, where it says in the course of the official's duty. The A4 amendments remove the language of state and standard report does not give rise to private rights of action, so that removes the language over on page 3. The A5 amendments increase the civil penalty to $5,000 and state that any fines collected shall be deposited in the terminal injury compensation account. The A6 amendments, and they require everyone to report, I understand the state of Vermont requires that. You will see some language at the back. That is basically a technical amendment. It has nothing to do with the special education. What it does is in the bill, it removes the definition in 419B005, the definition of public or private official. So that statute references that definition there. So we have to put that language in the back. So that particular statute, we still have those professions there. We now have the H7 amendments that allow state agencies that license the profession to take action to create a report. We have the A8 amendments remove the language concerning no liability and such a provision that would limit liability, leaves the amount blank. What you have in this, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, public and private officials include people that are licensed, but it also includes in the bill people who are public employees. And I think we have during the discussion the fact that people who are public employees, if they act within the scope of their employment, are limited by the Tort Claims Act, and they also, the employer is covered in court. So I think it was the feeling that some of those people representing the professional position, be no worse treated than public employees. But the amount was less lengthy in some discussion that maybe the amount should be $5,000, not $100,000. We also had discussions that maybe a lot of $500,000, which is the cap and passed in 1987 by the Tort Reform Act on, I believe, on non-economic damages. A9 amendments state that no liability if a public official came into contact outside his or her duty. Liability for public or private official keeping the student. And no liability outside their official public duties. Liability if the public or private official came into contact within his or her duty. One of the issues that happened in this field back in 1993, there was a limitation, and that was in the course of the official's duties. That language was removed in 1993. What you now have is the people who are public and private officials are on duty all 24 hours a day. So that would be one of the limits, just on duty, no liability. While on duty, the committee would have to fix the liability. The day 810 amendment applicability card states that it applies if the cause of action arising before or after the effective date, so that if the committee decides to go with the current language in the bill is adopted by the House with no liability, then it needs to do one thing one way or the other, and that's to clarify when it applies. Does it apply retroactively? Does it apply from the effective date of the bill? I know the courts would greatly appreciate the legislature at least addressing that issue.
Thank you. So that will give us plenty of food for thought. And Garrett or Mr. Heeman, who would like to begin?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is James Garrett. I practice law in Salem with the firm of Garrett Heeman, Robertson, Hollis, James, and Comstock. We're here today because it was suggested that it would be appropriate for us to share some of our experiences having to do with this reporting statute, not from the standpoint of the attorney or representing somebody involved in the statute, but as defendants. As defendants in a situation where it was alleged that a younger lawyer in our firm, who was an associate lawyer, became privy to certain information having to do with child abuse of a minor completely unrelated to the abuse that he was involved in. Young associate subsequently left the law firm and left the practice of law. And then after all of that occurred, suddenly we were named as a law firm as defendants in a damage action that was commenced on behalf of the minor child. We were made defendants principally not because we were personally involved in the fact situation, we weren't. So we were made defendants for the sole reason that we were employers, if you will, of the young associate lawyer, and under the theory of respondeat superior. And it was in that situation that we were brought to bear to have to defend this litigation. My name was on the complaint principally because I'm the first name on the letterhead and on the firm name. I had little or no, I had zero involvement in the case. Mr. Heeman, my colleague here, was more involved in the fact situation than in the defense than was I. And I asked Mr. Heeman to appear today, and he can relate a little more of the details than I. Suffice to say that the case has been resolved, and we're under a confidentiality order. We cannot divulge to you in the terms of any resolution, nor do we want to. But we're able to speak in the abstract, if you will, in terms of the respondeat superior aspects of the case.
Did your professional liability fund insurance cover this particular type of it's not really malpractice necessarily, but failure to report?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for asking that question. When we were brought into this litigation, the first and natural thing to do was to tender the defense to the professional liability fund. We, of course, have the mandatory basic coverage, but I believe at that time we also had the umbrella or the excess coverage. We were advised by the professional liability fund that they did not believe that the facts of the case, the failure to report as required by the statute, fell within the classic definition of the practice of law. And therefore, initially, they refused to defend and refused to cover. We thought we were covered then under an umbrella liability policy, which all of us have. And so if it wasn't the practice of law, it must have been the other. And so we tendered the defense of the case then to the umbrella carrier. And the umbrella carrier looked at the fact situation and said, well, that arose out of the practice of law. And therefore, they denied coverage. And so there we sat, with one pointing in two different directions. And on the at one point, it seemed that we were completely bare of any coverage whatsoever. Ultimately, and after a lot of effort, if you will, which involved a court case against one of our insurance carriers, it was brought to bear that there was going to be some coverage after all. But we cannot assume that the citizens of the state of Oregon who are in a position such as we, under the definition that's here, that are bought in under the concept of respondeat superior, will indeed find that their insurance carrier will defend them and paying indemnity if it's fine.
Hey, Brad.
Can I ask a couple of factual questions you may not be able to answer them? I wasn't clear. Did the employee learn of the abuse within the scope of his or her employment? And the other question is, did he or she let anyone else in the firm know of the scenario?
The answer to your first question is yes. The information came to the employee in the scope of his employment in the interviewing of a person. Did the employee make this information available to anybody else in the firm? I believe the answer is no.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to echo what Mr. Gregory said, but give a little different spin on it. We were specifically asked to be here because of the lines 7 and 8 on page 3 of the bill, and that is the reference to the violation of subsection 1 cannot give rise to a private right of action or claim for relief. It would be interesting, I think, for the committee to understand there's two basic ways that we were in jeopardy as a law firm, even though we weren't directly involved. And I will go back to the fact of how this came about, because I think you, without mentioning names, because I think you'll find that interesting as well. Respondeat superior simply means that an agency relationship, you're going to be liable if one of your agents does something wrong. That was one of the basis of possible liability under this claim, but there was also one that said, well, if not that way, then we think you might also possibly be liable for failure to properly supervise or properly train a subordinate so that they would bring the notification to light. Those were other allegations that were contained in the lawsuit. As Mr. Garrett indicated, we thought for sure, being prudent, that we should have coverage for any kind of wrongdoing, because nobody's perfect. If it arises from a mistake you make in the practice of law, you look to your professional malpractice carrier to cover you. If it's something else that doesn't relate to the practice of law, you look to your general liability carrier. And without either company admitting or conceding, if you will, that indeed there will be coverage for this kind of act under either the malpractice insurance or the general liability policy, the case was nonetheless settled for everybody's best interest. It obviously would involve these tremendous questions before appellate courts about whether or not there would have been coverage. The information that came to the associate was like third-hand hearsay. A told B, B told C, and C was talking to the client, our client, and our client relayed the information that this was a possibility, that there had been some abuse of a child. So it wasn't even direct information that came from the child, the abused child, or from someone that was in a position of being a parent for the child, something like that. It was like third-hand hearsay. I mention that because it's interesting how far the extent of liability can go in that fact situation. We don't know that the young man that was the associate attorney talked to anybody about it. We couldn't find out about that. All we knew was that we were winding up in the middle of a lawsuit. And quite frankly, it's our perspective that we are in favor of the reporting statute. We're not against that at all. We're not against a criminal penalty, a fine. I know one of the amendments here to raise the fine from $1,000 to $5,000. If that's appropriate, so be it. The problem, though, with making an employer, in this case, liable, leads one to the rather odd situation where the actual perpetrator of this wrongdoing, the person that committed the act upon the child, could maybe plead guilty to offense and get probation, but because they didn't have deep pockets, the injured parties or their family start looking around for who can respond in dollar damages. And that's where you can arrive at a conclusion that seems odd, that the person could be put on probation who actually committed the act, yet those of us who didn't have anything to do with it and heard about it third hand hearsay could be hit with multi-hundreds of thousands of dollars of potential claims. We believe that there should be some action taken to either eliminate the private right of cause of action or grant immunity from civil lawsuits. I know there's Amendment A-9 talks about immunity if it arises in the official context versus unofficial context. I'm not sure I know where that distinction lies about what's official and what's unofficial, but be that as it may, that's why we thought it would be helpful to be here today to tell you about the plight of what happens when you try and cover yourself, but you don't know that insurance is going to be there, nor can you watch everybody all the time about reporting. There were really two cases, too, that arose out of the fact situation. There were two victims, two young ladies were involved, and both lawsuits were brought against us ostensibly on the theory that had we reported this third-hand hearsay, neither one of those claims might have come about. The perpetrator might have been intercepted somehow before he could have done anything to these victims. I don't know where you draw the line. I have horror thoughts about what if someone was taking care of a Boy Scout troop or a Girl Scout troop, something like that, how this scenario could go on and on and on in terms of multiple claims. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions to these gentlemen? Senator Brown.
I guess in terms of your being ensued, I think that was sued. I think that was unfortunate. But the reality is, I mean, it could happen over any number of issues. And I guess my concern is if this had gone to a jury, you know, how do you think the jury would respond to what you talked about, third-hand hearsay, in this particular scenario? I mean, if it had gone to a jury, don't you think a jury might have reacted somewhat differently, or at least there would have been that possibility of the jury reacting differently?
Senator Brown, without speculating on what might do, I guess it would be important to put yourself in the context of where we were. The person who committed the terrible act was not a defendant.
Mm-hmm.
The young individual attorney that had worked for us was not a named defendant. The only entity being sued was the law firm that employed that individual. So, if you will, by carefully choosing who your defendants are, who your targets are, you can focus in just on that person's responsibility. No one else, I guess, needs to take responsibility for it.
Right. And I don't do trial. I'm not a trial lawyer, but don't people tend to choose the defendants in terms of looking for a deep pocket in any number of scenarios?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, Senator Brown, I can look at the list or the definitions, if you will, of categories.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that a lot of juries would look at them as wearing black hats.
Okay. Mr. Curtis, the other issue that this raised for me was the lack of awareness or knowledge in by lawyers of the abuse reporting requirements. And I guess it is my sense, and maybe your firm does something different, but my sense is, unless things have changed since I started practicing law, that there isn't a specific requirement out there that lawyers learn about the abuse reporting requirements. That there's, in fact, very little training that goes on in this arena, except for those lawyers probably who are in juvenile and family law court.
Senator Brown, I think that would be true not only among our profession, but all of the defined people here in this
I might also point out, too, one of the issues involved in the particular case we're involved in arose out of the question of whether or not the main the attorney, the young associate, had actually attended a continuing legal education session put on by the Oregon State Bar where the subject of reporting abuse was specifically covered at that session. So I can tell you that there are forces at work, the Oregon State Bar, the Professional Liability Fund, that are making attorneys aware of this statute all the time, and they're constantly talking about it in their continuing educational sessions. Because the theory, of course, on behalf of the plaintiffs was you had to know about the statute. You attended a CLE session where that was a topic that was being presented.
And of course, if it's given in the form of a confidential communication, then you don't disclose it. But as I understand in this situation, it wasn't confidential because the client brought in someone else to bolster the her while she was talking about whatever the issue was before the attorney. And so when you have a communication in front of a third party, then it's no longer confidential. Is that part of the fact scenario too?
Close, but not quite. The client, as I understand it, and I was personally there, and I'm not trying to dodge the sponsor. I'm just saying I didn't meet the client. The client ostensibly told the young lawyer, I've heard from others that this individual has done this bad thing. What we haven't disclosed so far is the client, in our case, had a child with the perpetrator. The client was then seeing us about issues affiliated with that. And we did not become privy to direct information from either the child, her family, or anybody else that this had taken place, only the hearsay information the client had, but that allegation that the client made to us about the individual who committed the deed wound up in an affidavit dealing with the question of custody of that particular child, of the child of our client, if you will, and the dispute over who ought to have custody of that child. And so the theory was, well, it's now public record. Why didn't you report it? Because you put it in an affidavit.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a question about the confidentiality of such communications, because I had a therapist who disclosed an abuse situation, and it was, I assume, it was privileged communication, but I don't know where the exceptions lie for the privilege.
It's ORS 419B.010 that says the exception for psychiatrists, psychologists, clergymen, or attorneys shall not be required to report such information communicated by a person if the communication is privileged. And then it cites the privilege statute. So that's the distinction. Yes, Sir Nichols.
My question is probably one of curiosity. You said the young lawyer is no longer in your firm and no longer practicing law because of this situation.
No, it's his personal choice.
Okay, I got scared out after all this.
It's personal choice.
Okay.
But from a factual standpoint, you can see the advantage for a plaintiff's attorney in naming a law firm or the doctor's clinic just because of the...
And none of us have any facts for the case.
Would Senator Brown, as a licensed practicing attorney, in her official duties as a legislator, be required to report some abuses she saw as a legislator?
She would if it were not in a confidential situation.
But she's not acting as an attorney.
Then she'd have to report.
But I mean, she's a legislator, but she has a law duty.
Yeah, unless you fall under the speech and debate exception.
See, if he was an insurance agent, it could be the same place. He could be a licensed practice attorney, and he'd be out investigating a claim to come upon some child abuse. Does he have an affirmative duty at that point to report the abuse?
Probably does if he's acting more in the insurance area than as an attorney.
Yeah.
The statute requires that the public or private official had contact with the child or have contact with the perpetrator. You mentioned that he never had contact with the child. How did he come in contact with the perpetrator?
How did the child come in?
No, how did your assessment?
The perpetrator was the other side, the adversarial side of a lawsuit which we were representing the client. But the acts of the perpetrator did not involve any other people within our lawsuit. Our client and the perpetrator had a child together out of wedlock, and the question dealt with the custody of that child and the time that that child would spend with each parent. The information about the perpetrator arose in the context of us trying to represent the best interests of the mother of the child and the child.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for your testimony. All right, Mr. Crew, can you give us the answers?
Well, my name's Mike Crew. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm here to represent the Oregon Medical Association. We're kind of a late comer to this debate. I would say that the OMA wants to go on record that it supports the reporting requirement. And we in terms of 2226, we support the amendment relative to scope. And we don't believe that the law is all that clear relative to a statutory cause of action being created by this bill. And I've taken a look at the cases. I'm not at all convinced it's there, but it's not for me to decide. But the OMA believe that the policy behind the statute is what is important. And that is why when we were in Mr. Taylor's office discussing what the positions of the various individuals were, or the organizations were, the OMA wanted to make it clear that it does indeed support the concept of reporting. We don't believe that reporting should be confined to the list of individuals set forth in the statute. We believe it should be expanded to every adult in the state of Oregon, so that they see it, whether you're a next-door neighbor or you're a plumber or whoever it may be, you should have the same duty as a lawyer or a doctor. And finally, we believe that the penalty for not reporting should be... should be. Now, again, we go back to the policy behind the statute, and that's reporting and presumably stopping abuse of children. And that's where we stand on this.
Would you agree that the policy should not include creating a private right of action?
We would agree with that. And that's the reason why we would support an increase in the penalty if the perception is that abuse is going unreported. I'll be very frank with you. We don't. That is not our perception at all. In fact, it's our understanding that there's only been four or five actions by the various district attorneys around the state since this statute came into effect, or this act came into effect, where they had to actually go after a failure to report. But if the belief is that abuse is not being reported, then by all means increase the penalty. Clearly the penalty is not insured, whether it's for attorneys or for doctors. And by the way, we talked to a number of malpractice carriers for physicians, and they made it very clear that if the abuse is seen while the physician's in the grocery store grocery shopping, there clearly is no coverage. And there is a split between the two largest carriers in the state that insure doctors as to whether there's any coverage if it is seen in the course and scope of practice, unless it's the victim that is being seen. Otherwise, it's a status violation. So physicians may find themselves in the very same position as we attorneys.
I think they would. I think the same scenario we just heard would apply to any profession.
Mr. Chair, maybe I didn't hear, but I was talking to someone the other day about this section on page 3, line 7-8, why that is needed, and it's a negative. It's a negative.
Right. We want to state our public policy. We're not intending by passing this action to create a private cause of action. Otherwise, a court could say by enacting this, we are at least impliedly saying if there is some failure to report in addition to the criminal penalty, it creates a private right of action.
Mr. Chair, as this is written, this would allow, would if an attorney or a solicitor's physician that get you guys off the hook for a while, a physician saw a child in her office that was being abused and she failed to do anything about it, this would prohibit someone suing that physician for failure to report or provide for a civil cause of action. If she saw the child in her office and she failed to report the abuse, it's very broad.
But that's in that scenario, if it occurred in the office and it was done by one of the employees, clearly the office would be liable for any abuse. Unlike the situation that was given here, where the attorney was not in any way responsible for the abuse that was being reported. so it doesn't preclude a lawsuit in that situation. And of course, the victim always has the right to sue the perpetrator who actually is doing the abuse.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that, depending upon the fact situation, the physician may well lose their license because it would be a violation of the Medical Practices Act not to report regardless of this statute.
Okay. Well, I don't agree with your interpretation of Section 1 and then Section 3 and how it reads.
Okay.
Members of the committee, and Mr. Crew is correct, there is no court decision on this particular statute. However, there are several other statutes where the legislature has imposed a duty. So I have one in front of me that relates to SCS, another one that relates to CSD at the time, another one that relates to the Drain Shaft Act and to the police department. Excuse me, police department duty to hold someone who's intoxicated in a story they didn't. But you have the difference here, you have a civil penalty, those other statutes did not. But I assume the insurance companies, two large insurance companies, have very confident legal counsel. My assumption is that they applied these cases by analogy. And so the courts have found a duty, a liability where the legislature has created a duty to do something, even though the legislature did not specifically address the issue of whether there's civil liability arising from those statutes. I assume that they assume that it implicitly was there.
So wouldn't page 3, lines 7 and 8, wouldn't that change that in terms of a civil cause of action?
Chairman, as the committee said, Brown, it would clarify that in this case, there is no civil liability for failure to report. Never been addressed by the court. You can distinguish it by the fact because there is a civil penalty. The courts could look at this and say that the legislature only intended a civil penalty and is having to determine that there be civil liability when they so will dispute.
And the chair did a memo for me that took a look at other states, and most states have come to the conclusion by creating a statute like this, it's not the intention of the legislature to create civil action. There was one state that was an exception. My concern is, I want to be absolutely clear on this. I mean, I think that's the responsibility of the legislature. So, Kate, if you can figure a way to word what I'm trying to do, that would be most helpful. But I think I want to leave a piece of very clear legislation so that area of interpretation is not left up to the court. Yep.
We're not taking school boards and teachers off the hook for those measures.
It would. The way it's written, you'd still have a duty to report. I mean, you could lose your license, you can receive the fine, it may be a criminal violation, but it doesn't, by the statute itself, create a private cause of action. Unless, and of course, if you are the person who's committing the abuse, you are responsible.
But under the chill, only by a penalty, someone couldn't sue you.
Which I believe is the intent of the legislation anyway, the law that exists today.
Okay, I just want to see that. Are we weakening, and with all due respect to the firms and the teachers and school workers, are we weakening the laws that we're putting in charge?
My answer would be no. We're clarifying them. And Kate Brown would say yes.
It's nice to be on the committee with a couple of attorneys that agree on everything.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I invite Rich Lane and Kirk Hall forward, please.
Chair?
Yes.
Is there any more discussion with me today?
No.
Okay, good.
Yes. Kathy, we have some testimony.
Senator Bryant, do you want us to make a presentation or respond to particular questions, or what?
I know you've been involved in the work group. Why don't you briefly? Have you testified before on this bill, Chris?
Only written testimony.
Why don't you briefly explain who you are and the significance of the proposed legislation?
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bryant. Members of the committee, my name is Kirk Hall. I run the Oregon State Bar Professional Liability Fund. We'll come back to that claim in a moment. we're here, I'm here on behalf of the PLF, which is part of the bar, chiefly in a law improvement mode. When this, originally there was a bill, House Bill 2270, before the House Judiciary Committee, which would have extended the reporting requirement to all adult Oregonians, which to me seems like a good idea if you want to cut down on child abuse. We went and supported that bill, and we suggested that the legislature also clarify the issue of whether or not there could be private lawsuits against people for failing to report. And we gave that committee two amendments. One said there shall be a private right of action, and one said there shall not be. And we said, clearly our belief is the better public policy is that there shouldn't be unlimited personal liability. But either way, please decide it and put it in the statute. I want to And that bill, for reasons I don't understand, the Department of Services to Children and Families, I guess, I wasn't at the hearing, but I guess they opposed expanding the duty to report to all adult Oregonians, so that died. And instead, the provisions that you see before you were put into House Bill 2226A passed the House 58-0 and are before you now. First time that I was aware there was any opposition to this bill was right after the hearing that you had in early May. Let me talk briefly about what, Senator Duncan, your question is a good one because it's not clear looking at this, where does this all come from? The laws of, virtually every state has a child abuse reporting requirement. In those states where this issue has reached their highest court, I think six or seven of the state courts have said, no, there is not a private right of action here. There is not a right to bring a lawsuit just because you have a duty to report and a fine associated with it. California in the mid-70s reached a different conclusion. I haven't read that case, and I don't know what their thinking was. So it is not clear in Oregon whether or not there is a right to bring a lawsuit for non-reporting. The problem is, and for this statute has been on the books for more than 20 years. I think it was first enacted in the early 70s. The problem is that lately, in the last two or three years, a few lawsuits have been filed. The problem with these lawsuits is, Senator Brown had a good question, which I thought I heard her saying, well, why don't you just let a jury decide this? What are you so worried about? That seems like your liability is pretty attenuated. The problem is that when you're faced with a lawsuit that's seeking unstated actual damages plus $500,000 in non-economic damages plus $5 million in punitive damages, which is the lawsuit that was filed against the Salem law firm you had here a moment ago, and you have a chance to settle it for a substantial amount but less than that, you know what people do. They will settle it. And my understanding is there was another case in Lane County brought against a clergyman, and I don't know anything more about that case, but my assumption is that that settled too. People are not willing to risk unlimited personal liability and everything they own just to get this up to the Oregon Supreme Court to find out whether or not there should be the right to bring a lawsuit for non-reporting. Okay. Let me add one more thing about the lawsuit. The two gentlemen from that firm did a good job of describing what happened. The reason that we looked at our policy, and not only was there a question whether or not this reporting obligation arose in the practice of law, but the more serious problem was every professional liability policy I've seen excludes claims for damages for physical injury or personal injury. We don't cover lawyers who hit someone in the nose or who sleep with their clients. And so in the lawsuit against this firm, the only damages were alleged were the sexual abuse of this teenage girl, which were physical damages, which were excluded under the policy. So we agonized about this, and we actually did end up giving a courtesy defense to the firm, and we contributed a portion of the substantial settlement on the claim. One other thing I want to say is the second lawsuit was even more attenuated. The theory on that one was, okay, we just found out this was filed a year or two after the first lawsuit. Through discovery, I believe, the plaintiffs or the plaintiff's lawyers discovered that there had been a second teenage girl with whom this 30-some-year-old perpetrator had a sexual relationship. The attorney never knew anything about it, never heard rumors or gossip about it, nothing. It couldn't have reported it, knew nothing about it. In fact, I think that it occurred long after the attorney received the information about the first teenage girl. But the theory of the second lawsuit was, if you had reported the abuser the first time around, when you should have, he would have been arrested then, he would have gone to jail, and he wouldn't have had an opportunity later to start sleeping with the second teenage girl. And in that lawsuit, they were seeking an unspecified amount of economic damages and another $500,000 of non-economic damages. So in theory, this could go on and on and on and on and on. And the main thing that we would like from... Let me mention one other thing about the doctrine of implied right of private action, the right to bring a lawsuit. When you read the cases, the Supreme Courts of these different states say, okay, we've seen an elaborate regulatory scheme set up by the legislature, and it seems to be protecting a particular group or class of people, so now let's figure out what the legislature really wanted here. Did they want to let private individuals bring lawsuits for violation, for damages for violation of the statute or not? And they'll go through an elaborate analysis, but the long and the short of it is they keep coming back to trying to figure out what did the legislature want when it enacted this thing. When you look at the cases from other jurisdictions, one of the comments is kind of interesting because the court says, well, you know, this statute doesn't provide for that, and it does provide for a civil fine, and it's been amended over and over and over again over a 20-year period, and we're just not going to imply, for the legislature presumably knows what the law is and so forth, and we are not going to imply from that that the legislature intended, in addition to a fine, that there be unlimited personal liability. So it's an unclear doctrine. It is unclear now. I would say, especially if you do something like increasing the fine and like perhaps even broadening the number of people who have to report, you're not decreasing victims' rights because it's not clear in Oregon yet. No appellate court has spoken to this issue. It's not clear whether you can sue under this statute. But the problem is you have particular individuals, and my understanding is that the same lawyers have a number of cases in the pipeline planned against clergymen. So there, it wasn't a problem for the first 20-some years. No one got sued, but in the last few years there have been lawsuits. We've never yet gotten an appellate decision on any of them. And I guess I would say to you, please make a decision one way or another and make it clear and put it in the statute so that people at least can know what their liability is and can plan accordingly and can perhaps try to find insurance for that if it's an insurable subject. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Blaine.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and we oppose HB 2226. We've heard a lot right now about umbrella coverages and excess coverages and coverable events, and I think we've lost sight of what this statute was designed to do and who it's supposed to protect, and what trade-offs the legislature decided to achieve that purpose. And it's worth commenting, the purpose of the mandatory reporting is to protect children from abuse. And to achieve that, very limited burdens are placed on certain identified officials. They must have reasonable cause to believe, first, that an abuse has taken place. So I heard about double and triple hearsay and how this information may have come to the individual official. But he's got to have he or she has got to have a reasonable cause to believe that an abuse is occurring. And if a report is made, the official has complete immunity from any civil or criminal liability if he or she makes that report in good faith with reasonable grounds for making the report. If he or she makes the report, CSD steps in and has the opportunity to remove a child from an abusive, perhaps dangerous situation. Now, all these other alternative remedies about licenses being pulled for failure to report such a violation, increasing the fines for failing to comply with the mandatory, does nothing to protect the child victim that the original mandatory reporting was passed and is articulated as the policy of the state.
You don't think the threat of losing your license, either to practice law or to practice medicine, does nothing to encourage attorneys or doctors to report abuse?
Well, I think it encourages the particular official to comply with the statute, Senator Bryant. I don't think that it does anything to protect the original child victim who's supposed to be able to have a right to enforce these mandatory provisions that have been passed. Where do you
see the victim having the right to enforce the mandatory provision? Where does it state that in the existing law?
Oh. Senator Bryant, members of the committee, I would agree with Mr. Hall. At this point in time, we clearly don't know whether there is a private right of action under the mandatory reporting statutes as it's listed today. I think Mr. Hall mentions that a number of courts have considered it and found an implied right of action, and others have rejected it. Mr. Taylor pointed out that some of the other Oregon cases that have found
private right of action under similar types of statutes are different than the mandatory reporting because there are civil penalties provided under present existing child report mandatory reporting provisions. So it's an open question whether there is an implied right of action. My point in response to your question is that this bill as it's drafted now prohibits, outright eliminates the victim's right to proceed with a private right of action for the failure to comply with the mandatory reporting. And that's the part that's objectionable in 2226 as we have before us today.
Do you think in the situation of Mr. Garrett and Mr. Seidelman, do you think it was appropriate for this statute to provide a cause of action against them?
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, there were a number of issues raised in that presentation. I think there was some objections that I heard as to respondent superior vicarious liability being applicable at all under that situation. And I think that's away from the debate today. If you're involved in an accident with Acme Trucking, you never sue the driver of Acme Trucking. You sue Acme Trucking, failing to trade or train or properly have their drivers doing what's required of them under the law. That doesn't surprise me that the firm might have been the named defendant. The other thing that I heard was that the abuser was not there for the jury to consider. It was only the law firm. As Senator Bryant is familiar with, 1995 and 1997, the joint and several liability rules have been significantly modified, and the defendant is entitled to bring in anybody to have the jury consider if somebody else is liable in tort for the injuries claim. And finally, the amount of damages or the claim that would be asserted against the attorney who failed or the physician or any of the other officials who fails to report is going to be limited to what that party can prove the failure to report caused in damages. It's not everything running retroactively back to the day that the abuse started, but there would be an entitlement to damages for harm suffered after the reporting could have been made, the harm that was caused after that. So I don't think it's as wide open as some of the other testimony would indicate.
But I would acknowledge by the uncertainty of the situation right now, it would subject any professional group in that fact situation to be subject to a lawsuit that where they may have no knowledge of the alleged abuse, that they may have no insurance coverage, that if there's a claim continuing to damages, it also then requires them to usually hire a second attorney because of the excess claim, that their, of course, their personal assets are also at risk. Do you think that that is an appropriate public policy that the Oregon legislature should support?
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, I think that the legislature should support the policy that the person who is harmed by somebody's failure to report is entitled to present their case and pursue a private right of action. This bill eliminates that right. They're just shut out completely. And some of the other hypotheticals that you just posed in your question, I don't know that punitive damages are ever covered in insurance under any situation.
No, I'm saying they're not, but I'm saying as a tactical matter, if you allege the punitive damages, that requires the defendant then to usually hire an excess or another attorney, and also it subjects the individual to turning over all of their individual and private financial information.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, we're moving away from the merits of allowing the victim to pursue a private cause of action and now wading into the merits of having a punitive damage claim in any case, because that situation where one is forced to hire an individual to protect his or her own personal assets or required to turn over financial data to be able to give the opportunity to the opposing party to figure the amount of punitive damages to make them sting, in the old law book phrase, that applies in any type of cause of action. So
We're moving away from what this victim should be entitled to, whether this victim gets the right to come into court at all.
Well, my point is to allow the victim to come into court at all and sue the non-abuser. You open right now, you're opening all this what I would call a Pandora's box. And what my interest is currently I do not believe that the legislature intended to create a separate cause of action, a private cause of action by enacting the statute 20 years ago or never happened. And I think it's our obligation to clarify exactly what our intent is. And if we're going to compromise this and say, well, we want some sort of a civil action available, I want the legislature to say what that civil action is, or say there is no civil action, which I think is the current state of the law. That's where the chair is.
I wonder where the governor is.
I don't know. but that is something we need to find out. And I would hope that the governor would also see the logic in that, because he was probably in the legislature when the first bill was passed.
Senator Bryant, if I may, members of the committee, the other thing that you talked about is this official capacity business, just for the chair's information. Apparently, the official capacity language that was in the original mandatory reporting statute was removed in 1993. It shows up in the 1991 ORS version. The 1993 version, it is gone. So I don't know the rationale that was presented at that time for having 24-hour-a-day duties versus being responsible for information that you obtain inside the course and scope of your professional duties, whether it's physician or doctor.
Okay. I appreciate your testimony, Rich. I'm not picking on you. It's just the issue.
I'm from
Kirk. Senator Bryant, I just wanted to add one thing. There are precedents for either eliminating the liability. There's parts of ORS where the legislature has said there will not be a private right of action. There's also places where you've capped it. There's ORS 30.298 says that the SCF, Services to Children and Families, can't be held liable for more than $5,000 for civil liability for damage done in a foster home where they've placed a child. So it is not unheard of to exercise your discretion to either say there isn't liability or if there is, that there's a cap on it.
Well, of course, we put caps on public liability all the time. We have a $100,000 cap and a $500,000 cap in there.
And as the earlier speaker said, right now, even though you've got a narrow list of reporters, which is probably less than 0.5% of Oregonians have any duty to do anything at all about child abuse. I should go back. They talked about the hearsay evidence. A told B, B told C, C told the lawyer. A, B, and C don't have to report anything, face no fine, face no civil liability. They can go home even if they saw the child abuse happen. They have no liability, cannot be sued right now. But D, who happens to be either an optometrist or a doctor or a firefighter or any of the people on this list who hears this, can now be put at risk for unlimited personal liability. I think this committee has either four or five lawyers and three non-lawyers. All of you could go out in the parking lot, see the same thing happen. Three of you could go home and do nothing about it, and the rest of you would have to report it or have unlimited personal liability. So please do something to clarify this situation.
Senator Turner.
I thought reasonable cause had a played a role in this issue. When you've got four people telling you hearsay information, where does reasonable cause stop and hearsay begin?
That'll be the jury. The jury gets to decide that, and most people don't want to risk all their assets on that decision.
That'll be $100,000 in attorney's fees and 2 years of heartburn. You'll find out.
You asked, someone mentioned making everyone mandatory reporters. Would you support going that route?
Well,
so we wouldn't have sort of arcane distinctions between whether Senator Nelson is a bar member and then therefore an attorney or whatever.
I think farmers should answer that.
Senator Brown, personally, not speaking in my role as a CLF, I think that's a great idea. A number of states require all adults in their state to report child abuse. But those are the states that have also said you're subject to the fine, whatever the legislature says the fine is, but you're not subject to unlimited personal liability and a private right of action. I think it would, as hard as it is for the list of reporters in the statute to deal with personal liability, I suppose other people would find it impossible to deal with the chance that they're going to lose it all in a lawsuit. So I don't think you should expand it if you're going to leave unclear whether or not there's personal liability.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Yes.
Curious. Is the Department of Justice supportive of the amendment?
Right now, No, they're not, and I had a talk with the lobbyist for the Farm Bill, or Ms. Granger. Her main objection is they want to be taken off the bill. Whatever ends up happening to it, they do not want their name to be as a sponsor anymore since they feel they've lost control of what initially happened.
Mr. Chair, I think SED still wants to be part of the group that's included within the mandatory reporters. I think they wish that Section 2 would find another vehicle.
Well, you need to find another vehicle for me and a vehicle that would move.
Okay. I think there's another power we need to deal with in this debate, so just...
We'll close the public hearing then, and on this today on 2226, and open a work session on Senate Bill 722. I believe since we sent this to before, I need to move. The chair would move to suspend the rules for purposes of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 722. Without objection to order. Rules are now suspended. The chair would move that we reconsider our vote by which we sent 722 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Objection, hearing none. Order. The chair then would open a work session on Senate Bill 722. And we have some amendments, Dash 7s, and what the Dash 7s do is they correct one technical amendment, and then they adopt the idea that was proposed by the Treasurer that allows the public employers who have an unfunded liability to go ahead and bond that, thereby paying their money into PERS and allowing that those contributions then to have some earnings, and that then would lessen their liability. And then the other part of it was something I meant to include in the Tier 3, which dealt with the unused sick leave, that no part of the unused sick leave may be added to the final average salary, because I don't think that was the intent of the sick leave. So those are the changes. Ann, is there anything specific you'd like to point out?
Sure. I just passed out a statement from Mr. Johnson. One of you actually got my copy that has the savings handwritten on the back of it. But they are here.
Mark, why don't you come forward, and also Fred?
On the back, you'll see the ultimate savings at 1.93%. What we were looking at, 7.2 that the committee initially approved, or passed out of committee, was a 1.47% savings, which Mark, I think, informed us was just a comparison, Mark, between the bill that the committee passed out first and then this one.
Maybe we should do this. Mark, if you could identify yourself and then explain to us the letter of May 26th that you've written, Fred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm an actuary with Millman & Robertson. We have a contract to provide actuarial services to the Retirement Board. And the letter you have in front of you is two pages. It is my estimate of the impact of the amendment that Senator Burns discussed, and that is the elimination of unused sick leave. The previous estimates of savings of Senate Bill 722 before this amendment was that the employers would be responsible for a contribution that would be 1.47% of payroll less than the cost of current Tier 2. So that's the differential between the cost of a new member now under Tier 2 versus what it would be if Senate Bill 722 passes. And at the top of page 2, you can see that the elimination of the unused sick leave program will result in an additional savings of 0.46% of payroll. Therefore, the total savings is estimated to be 1.93% of payroll. As you recall, since this is a new tier of benefits and only applies to members hired after the effective date of the Act, the savings will emerge slowly over time. It may, depending upon the employer, a small employer that has turnover and and a brand new employee under this particular provision, it will cost less immediately. A large employer, it will take a generation of workers to get to the point where the savings is the 1.93% of pay. In terms of $1,999 dollars, looking 30 years out, 1.47% of pay represents about $84 million per year in today's dollars. 1.93% represents about $110 million per year in today's dollars. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Again, this letter today is looking at only page 4, starting on line 19, the section 3.
Based upon a 30-year experience, then what would the total savings be?
Well, it's going to be huge. I mean, if you take almost 2% of payroll, current payroll is, of the system is almost $6 billion, and will be shortly. That's absolutely a huge number, and if you work with inflation, we're talking probably billions of dollars. I have not factored that out. That's not typically how we cross out, shown this in the past, but suffice it to say, it's a huge number. 2% of payroll of all public employees covered by PERS is a very large number.
The reason I ask that is because I'm asked that question. If this is adopted over the 30-year period, what were the savings would be? So if you could give me an estimate of that, that would be helpful. The other item was that the governor has sent me a letter indicating that he had interest in a Tier 3 that had a cap on investment. So it's a different type of a Tier 3, and I understand that you have reviewed that and also written an actuarial letter concerning that proposal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And can you just briefly describe what that type of Tier 3 would do?
Senator Bryant, on May 24th, I wrote a letter to Fred McDonald, the director of PERS, describing the difference between Senate Bill 722 as it passed out of this committee previously in a proposal that was submitted to us for review. That proposal would have done several things. Number one, it would have limited the total benefit payable from PERS to 60% of final average salary. So there's an upper limit on the benefit that could be paid out. And at the same time, it essentially raised a benefit, if you will, by providing a minimum interest guarantee of currently 8% for member account balances. So that in a poor investment year, currently a Tier 2 member is going to have a low interest rate credit. This would support that with a floor of the interest rate of currently 8%. The savings for making just those two changes to the current Tier 2 was 0.7% of payroll, as compared to now your amended, if you pass it, 1.93%. So about a third of the savings, in our estimation, for the proposal. And that comes because the money match is still there for Tier 2. What this proposal that we cost it out would do would be to limit the benefit. So you've got just kind of a cap. What's going to happen is that the long service employees might reach a point where they're not earning any more benefits from PERS. So there are a lot of personnel type issues that we've commented on, and we'd certainly be happy to share that letter with you if you'd like to see it.
I think it'd be good if the committee received a copy of that letter, and so that we'd be advised as far as that. Committee, the other disagreement between 722 and the governor's letter deals with the opt-out, where the governor proposed that we not have the opt-out. Senator Brown.
Two questions. Mark, on this letter, on page 2, you say the bill is passed by the committee had an ultimate average savings of 1.47 of payroll over Tier 2.
Correct.
Was that strictly the third tier, or was that all of the menu?
No, that's Well, yeah, it's everything that was contained in Senate Bill 722. And what that means is that as you hire a new employee after the bill passes, our expectation of the total cost of the PERS package for that employee is 1.47% of payroll less over their entire career.
Mr. Chair, to follow up. So you say here the unused sick leave program results in ultimate savings of 0.46. Can you tell me what the third tier savings are as opposed to all the other fixes that we made in the bill?
Well, my understanding is that the unused sick leave, the elimination of the unused sick leave is only for the third tier.
That's right. It'd only be for the, we can't affect the first and the second.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, Fred McConnell, Director of PERS. Senator Brown, if you're asking about the other items that are contained within 722, are those like a variable and so on? What Mark's number is, the 1.47, is only addressing the third tier. It's not addressing the other items that are in that bill.
Okay.
Senator Brown.
I assume in terms of the elimination of the unused sick leave program, I assume from a policy perspective, what you're doing here is encouraging people to use their sick leave. So instead of coming to work, they will stay home.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, certainly the sick leave was a feature brought on by the schools largely to encourage people to judiciously use their sick leave. And how what the dynamics of that would be somewhat speculative,
but certainly
that was the that was the motive behind it.
Mark, I guess Mark talked about the cap in terms of employees tapping out. I assume there's going to be some consequences of eliminating the unused sick leave program.
Actually, from a practical standpoint, Senator Brown, there's very little impact because right now we expect virtually all current members to retire under the money match formula because of the high interest credits. There is no effect on the money match formula from the unused sick leave program, because the unused sick leave program only adjusts the calculation of your average salary, which has nothing to do with the money match benefit. So to the extent that it wouldn't apply here in the third tier, it really doesn't apply now anyway, practically, for most people.
Could you repeat that again?
Yes. The unused sick leave program, currently in effect today, adjusts final average salary. Final average salary is a determinant of your benefit if you're retiring under either the pension plus annuity formula or the full formula. Final average salary has no impact on the calculation of the benefit under the money match calculation method. That is simply your account balance times two annuitized. So since virtually all retiring members are going out under the money match calculation method, the unused sick leave program is not being utilized today.
I could make it clear, Mr. Chair, under the Duncan model, I didn't get the count on used sick
leave. You know, we still haven't seen the Duncan model. Committee, don't you remember being, we're going to have this anonymous graph that was going to show us
a
retired school superintendent who's also a senator?
With all the numbers changed.
Right. We haven't seen that yet.
We'd still be happy to do that.
So you couldn't show who it was.
That's right. Question on the bonding. On the bonding issue that's in the Dash 7 amendments, and I tried to explain it, but am I correct then that we'll actually save the employers some money if they can bond at the lower rate, put the money in where the money can earn?
My understanding, Chair Bryant, that that indeed is the case, that they would use the funds to pay off their unfunded liability, and not only would they have more to invest and more earnings to be realized, but at least theoretically, the cost of the bonding would be less than paying it off through our system.
Do you have an estimate of what the savings would be?
I do not, Mr. Chairman. I would imagine Treasury might be able to answer that, but I do not know.
We could maybe get an idea.
We could certainly provide some information with regard to the additional earnings that could that the actual cost of.
All right, that would be helpful. Raleigh, do you have an estimation?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock, Chief of Staff of the Oregon Treasury. We did a run looking at a potential pot of about $315 million, actually, of pooled assets, and show about a 21% savings. And We're doing a par value then of about $321 million. Estimated the interest rate about 7%, which is going today. These would have to be sold taxable, and there's some question about whether they can be sold as tax exempt. That's iffy. It may take some real money to figure out whether we can do that.
But if they're tax exempt, they'd be 5% interest versus 7% or something like that.
And that's, so it's probably worth spending the time to look at that additional 2%. But you know, basically, present value savings as a percentage of the unfunded liabilities, about 21%. That's a big number.
So what would that number be?
About just a hair under $70 million on $300 million. But there are some other issues that I need to point out, and we can address them on the House side. I assume this is where it's going. There's some other issues to be dealt with.
Right. We do have to send it to the House.
Yeah. Let me point out that there's some questions that we would like to raise and that you need to be aware of before you move this forward. We can do this. We think we can do this. We're not saying stop here, but understand that we need to talk a little bit about the down market analysis that needs to be done. Or, you know, we've looked at a very strong market, and we'd like to make sure that everybody that participates in this understands it down. And there are some questions relevant to pooling about the credit and how we would look at the credit, whether we have to get individual credit or whether we can just do a broad underlying credit of the issue, and those are significant issues in how you market it. And so there are issues that you still yet need to be dealt with. The taxable issue needs to be dealt with, so we still have some work to do on this.
True, because you have to answer the pooling question. Otherwise, you're going to have all kinds of problems from employers.
Mr. Chair, that's right between the eyes. If we don't have the pooling question resolved, and that'll be an issue of what their credits are and then, you know, how we sell this, everybody, this is a one-shot deal. You know, you either play or you don't play, and it makes sense for you, but we need to go through all those issues, and there's still some other issues to go through.
When do you think you might have some answers on those issues?
And we're working on it as we speak, so.
2 weeks?
Hopefully.
Okay.
We're going
to
run.
I have to ask Mark Johnson another stupid question. You said, or what I heard you say is that the unused sick leave program doesn't cost employers any money because the market is doing well. Correct. Because the short frame, it takes out a couple steps, but basically employees choose the money match as opposed to the other option. Correct?
Correct.
Assuming the market continues to do well, is it also true then they will, and assuming employees continue to up the money match, is it true then there will also be no savings as you suggested in terms of payroll?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, no, that's not true, because under Senate Bill 722, remember, it's called the pension plus annuity. The benefit is calculated in two pieces. The annuity piece is the employee's money, which is subject to the market rates of return. But the other piece of that is the pension is a defined benefit formula.
Okay.
1% times years of service times final average salary. That piece has nothing to do with market rates of return, but everything to do with service and salaries. It's when the formula has something to do with salaries that the unused sick leave would come into play. And we had factored that in our previous calculations for Senate Bill 722, and then yesterday took it out. So there would still be, even though it's high market rates of return, that pension piece would still be subject to the unused sick leave program.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question. Thank you for the clarification.
Oh, Senator Cardin. Stupid question. The rate of inflation, is that anything to do, what do you do with that? You just come up with, is that even involved in this?
Oh, yes.
Oh, it is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I see. And your rate of inflation is what? Is a certified smart actuarial? That's what I do. What do they call you? They call you
certified.
What do they teach you in your schools of actuarial? It's the basic rate of inflation when you do these kind of things.
They don't teach that. You get your dartboard out and you start throwing.
And you what?
Get
imagine
dartboard.
So what if you should be doctored? Okay, go ahead.
Senator Courtney, in March of 1998, we presented a study to the Retirement Board with our recommendations for all of the assumptions that go into funding to ERS. What we're trying to do is to predict what the benefits are going to be so we can get enough money in this fund to pay everything.
Right.
When you have a benefit that's based on future salaries, that includes inflation. So does investment, our expectation of investment rate of recession.
And recession.
And recession. Our estimate is, currently that we're using is 3.5%.
And how often, how does the recession get in there? Does that include every 10 years? How do you do that?
Well, the actuaries have a much longer view than even that, because our predictions are going out 30, 40, 50 years or more. So, for example, every 2 years when I make this recommendation, I call up the state economist, I talk to Paul Warner, and I said, you know, are you comfortable with 3.5? And he always says, no, it's too high. And I said, well, he's talking about 90 days or, you know, something like that. I said, well, I'm talking about 50 years. And can we come to an agreement of what's reasonable? And we always do. And it's there's no right answer. It's just an estimate. But
so you and Paul are the ones that come up with this rate of inflation. And I'm not trying to smile.
And now the professor from Portland State, who's the interim economist in Sarah Gates.
Isn't that you a little nervous?
I'm making predictions all the time. I'm making thousands of predictions. It's probably millions of predictions when you factor in how many people are involved here. And Senator Courtney, you won't be able to tell if I'm wrong for about 50 or 70 or 100 years from now.
No, I'll never be able to tell if you're wrong. That's comforting. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll let you know.
All right, committee, if you handcuff just for a second here. The chair would move the dash 7 amendment to Senate Bill 722. Discussion, objection.
I'm moving
the dash 7.
I'm going to object.
Well, you want to object to the amendments, or you want to
object
to the amendments?
I'm object to the amendments.
Okay,
objection.
All right, 2 objections to the amendments.
3
objections to the amendments.
Mr. Chair. Full explanation.
Yeah.
As a Chris, I just got here. I'm going to go along with you on this one. But I reserve the right later on to do whatever I might want to do.
Thank you. Motion carries. Please record 3 as naysayers. And then the chair would move Senate Bill 722 as amended to the floor. Please record the 3 individual senators as naysayers again. Motion carries. The same vote explanation for Senator Duncan.
Yes, I may vote against it on the floor.
I
understand. I that right.
I understand. I will carry this bill with a lot of help. Now, we have 1 second. We have 1 reconsideration for a conflict amendment. And so I suspend the rules. I move to suspend the rules for purposes of possible reconsideration of House Bill 2425. Objection. Carrying this so ordered. The rules being suspended, I now ask to reconsider the vote by which we send House Bill 2425 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Objection, seeing none so ordered. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2425, the bill in fact for, and Anne.
The Dash A6 amendments resolve conflict with Senate Bill 795. They contain the A5 amendments that you did adopt yesterday. So you're looking to adopt the
A6
amendment.
It's the
dash highest.
It's
the highest.
We love it.
All right. And the dash 6?
A6.
The chair would move the dash A6 amendment to House Bill 2425. Discussion, objection, so ordered. Chair then would move House Bill 2425 as amended to the floor due pass. Discussion, objection, so ordered. Same carrier as before?
Senator
Burdick. Thank you.
He doesn't even like dogs.
Okay. I will now, I know we have to go to the floor, but I want to take the public testimony on House Bill 3376, so if you need to go, I'll stay here and take the testimony as a subcommittee. I'm sure, pardon?
We're under call.
I will recess until the call is removed, and then my intent is to take testimony on this particular bill. On the other bills, they are... Yes. They're all public hearings. Work session, right.